This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
For this month's Ask an Astronomer, we're in a slightly unusual location. Rather than the Jodcast studio, we're sat looking out at the Lovell telescope, which I think is moving around at the moment. And I think I can just hear the sound of it whirring down. So hopefully it won't interrupt the recording too much. The first question comes from Derek Kilkenny Blake, and he's talking about circles and ellipses. So he says, we all know that the Earth takes about 365 days to make a full orbit of the Sun, but if the orbit was a circle and took 360 days, and then we overlaid the ellipse of the Earth's real orbit on top of that, would there be an extra bulge of the ellipse that would be about the missing 2.5 days on each side? Or is it not that easy?
Yeah, it's quite a complicated question, that one. It's not that easy, is the simple answer, but we probably better explain why. And I think to explain about the shapes of orbits, really, what you have to do is go back about 400 years to Kepler. So in the early 1600s, Kepler, through observations of planets and their movements around the Sun, which he worked on with Tycho Brahe, he came up with these three laws, famous Kepler's three laws. And the first law that Kepler formulated was that the orbit of every planet is actually an ellipse. So in other words, a sort of squash circle with the Sun at one of the foci of the ellipse. So an ellipse has two foci, focuses if you prefer. So not right in the centre of this sort of squash circle, but just offset to either side of the centre are these foci. So the Sun would be at one of those and the Earth would go round and round it in an ellipse. So that's his first law. The second is actually that if you sort of drew a line between the planet and the Sun, and you imagine that planet sweeping round as the planet orbits the Sun, then it would actually, that line would sweep out equal areas in equal times. Now that maybe is a bit hard to imagine, but the way to think about it is, as the planet orbits the Sun, it comes closer to the Sun at one side of its orbit and then farther away at the other side, because the Sun's sort of offset from the middle in this elliptical orbit. So when it comes close to the Sun, the planet is feeling a stronger force of gravity and it speeds up. It's equal areas in equal time because it sweeps around a sort of bigger angle in an equal amount of time as it comes near the Sun, and then slows down as it goes out to larger distances. And the third law is all about how you relate the time it takes for the planet to orbit the Sun, its orbital period, to the distance the planet is from the Sun, the sort of average distance of the planet from the Sun. And it basically tells you the square of the orbital period is proportional to the cube of the sort of average distance of the planet from the Sun. So those are Kepler's laws. For answering this question, really it's just the first law that we need about ellipses. And I suppose, go back to Derek's question, what he imagined was this sort of elliptical orbit for the Earth, so it's like a rugby ball shape, and it takes about 365.25 days for the Earth to go around that orbit. And then he's imagined drawing a circular orbit sort of in the middle of that ellipse. So you can imagine just fitting a circle inside that sort of elliptical rugby ball shaped orbit. He's saying if that circle were a sort of 360-day orbit, would the sort of extra 2.5 days be the bulges on either side from the elliptical orbit? And in fact, that's not true at all, really. It's much more messy than that, really. And one thing I think that's sort of interesting to think about is that if you get this circular orbit sitting in the middle of this ellipse, and you imagine that if that was circular, the Sun would be at the centre of it. But in fact, for the real elliptical orbit, the Sun's offset to one side. And you can work out how far off to one side it would be for the real Earth's elliptical orbit. And it's actually about 2.5 million kilometres off to one side of the centre of the circle.
Quite a long way.
It does sound like a big number. I mean, I can't even imagine what 2.5 million kilometres is, but in terms of the size of the Earth, it's 200 Earth diameters. So you'd have to take the Earth and shift it by 200 times its own size out to one side. So that is a lot, although looked at another way, it's only about 1/120th of the average diameter of the Earth's orbit. The diameter is about 300 million kilometres, so in that sense, it's a small perturbation on the scale of the orbit. And I suppose coming back again, just to finish off with Derek's point about the 360-day circle, I thought, let's imagine doing that. Let's take the Earth's real elliptical orbit, slightly squashed circle, not very much squashed, slightly squashed, draw a circle in the middle of it, how long would it take a planet like the Earth to orbit that circle, that particular circle? And you can calculate that from Kepler's laws, and you get a period of 365.1 days. So it's hardly different at all from the 365.25 for the actual ellipse. So if we go back to his question, it doesn't get you. I think he was wondering about things like, you know, is the 360 a special number because there's 360 degrees in a circle? But even allowing for that perfect circular orbit, it only moves you from 365.25 to 365.1. Assuming I've done the maths right. Someone can write in and tell us if I have.
So perhaps 360 is just a convenient round number that's perhaps close to 365.
Yeah, I think that might be right. I think that might be right for circles. I mean, I'm not sure about the historical antecedents of 360 degrees in a circle, to be honest, yeah.
The second question comes from Pat O'Grady, and he has a question, again related to orbits, but this time about comets. He says, my understanding is that long period comets come from a place called the Oort cloud. Some event pushes them out of their orbit and towards the Sun and the inner solar system. When they have gone by the Sun and go off back out again towards the Oort cloud, what is it that brings them back in again? Does the Sun's influence end at the heliosphere? And if so, what is there to stop them flying on past the Oort cloud and out into deep space?
Good question. So I think there's probably just a few things that we'll just talk about to set the scene for people who haven't heard about these things before. So these long period comets he's talking about. So we know about things like, say, Halley's Comet, whose period, if I remember rightly, is 76 years. Does that ring a bell?
Could be. I was too young to remember the last time it came around. I hope to see it again.
I actually did see Halley's Comet in 1986. So I was in America at the time. So we went up a nearby hill in Virginia, and I saw the tail extending over quite a large part of the sky. Not very bright, but it was there. So luckily enough, because I don't think I'll be around for the next one. So that's about, 76 years. These long period comets are much longer orbital periods than that. So ranging from something like a few hundred years to out to maybe millions of years. So extremely long orbits, highly eccentric ellipses, which means, you know, very squashed circles. If you can imagine them, very squashed down as they come into the Sun and then way back out again. And they'll go out to maybe distances of tens of thousands times the distance of the Earth to the Sun, an astronomical unit. So tens of thousands of AU, we call them. And I suppose, again, just to give you some scale for that, in terms of these astronomical units, distances of the Earth to the Sun, Neptune is about 30 astronomical units away. Eris, which is the most distant dwarf planet, is about 100 astronomical units. And these long period comets will go out to tens of thousands of AU. So they're a long way out from what we think about as the solar system. And in fact, if you think about what's beyond that, the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, is about 300,000 AU, almost 300,000. So we know of comets that we think go out to about maybe 70,000 AU. So they're like a quarter of the way to the nearest other star. So, you know, so that's the sort of extent of the orbits we're talking about. It's really, they're really huge. And this Oort cloud, that Pat referred to is, it's a hypothetical thing. We've not directly observed the Oort cloud. It's suggested to be this reservoir of comets, many billions of comets, out to these sorts of distances, you know, out to maybe a quarter or so the distance to the nearest star. And it's thought to be where these long period comets come from, in the same way that Pat mentioned it, that you might get a, you know, movement of the Sun through the Milky Way. There's perturbations from the gravity of nearby stars and that, or even the orbits of the comets within the Oort cloud. They come near to one another and perturb one another, and one could have its orbit deflected and it would, you know, sort of fall in into the inner solar system.
So it doesn't take much to do that then?
No, well, you just need to add some energy to the orbit or extract some energy from the orbit to change the shape of the orbit. And so that would be sort of happening all the time. And I guess it would be, you know, the more extreme ones that would deviate the orbit so much that it would fall right in. But it's certainly not an improbable thing to happen. And when we see these long period orbits, these long period comets, we see them with orbital inclinations. So if you imagine the solar system with all the planets orbiting the Sun, they all orbit in approximately the same plane, in a sort of flat surface, if you like. But these comets are often at steep angles to that plane. And so it's thought that this Oort cloud is probably roughly spherical. So it sort of surrounds the whole of the solar system, and the comets can come in from any angle, if you like. So they fall into the Sun. So although we haven't observed it directly, that's the best idea we have for where these long period comets come from. And they can have all sorts of shapes of orbit. I mean, basically, if they're bound to the sun, if they're what we call gravitationally bound, so they're sitting under the influence of the sun, which dominates the mass of the solar system, they'll continue to orbit, they'll continue to come back time and time again. And generally, they'll be in elliptical orbits. If you can add energy to that, you can actually make that orbit become a hyperbola. And that means that the comet would then have enough energy, it would leave the solar system altogether. It would escape the sun's influence and head off into deep space. Now, Pat's question really was, why when one of these things falls in, why doesn't it just head back out into deep space? Well, it was always bound to the sun. It was orbiting the sun in the Oort cloud. And so when it falls in, quite often it will still be orbiting the sun. It'll take a long time, take millions of years to come back near to the sun again, but it probably will do that for the majority of objects that we know. If it comes close to another object and it has a gravitational collision with it, in sense, you know, it doesn't have to actually hit it, but it comes close enough that it's deflected, you can gain energy from that collision, or you can lose energy from that collision, depending on how it, and the nature of it. And so you can modify those orbits, so you can make things be captured, or you can make things be ejected. And I think probably the other key thing to say is the point that was made about the heliosphere being the edge of the sun's influence. And I think this is something that, you know, is a misconception, isn't it? That
there is really an edge to the solar system, maybe, yeah. is a misconception.
Yeah. And it's because, well, it's in the news, isn't it, at the moment, because there's this massive argument going on about Voyager 1, and when does Voyager 1 reach the edge of the solar system? And so you've heard this concept of this heliosphere, the region of space dominated by the sun. And actually what that means is it's the sun has this solar wind particles and radiation that's flooding out from the sun all the time. But that solar wind of particles, as it spreads out, will eventually slow down and be stopped by the interstellar medium, the gas that surrounds the sun that sits between the stars. And it's that point is the sort of the edge of the heliosphere. And the debate at the moment about Voyager 1 looks like it's more or less at that edge. There's debate over whether it's just crossed it or not. But that's only 120 astronomical units away from the sun now. So remember, we were talking about Eris being 100 AU, Neptune being 30 AU, and these long period comets going out to 70,000 AU. So these things are well beyond this heliosphere, but they're still under the influence of the sun. And that's because the sun's gravity carries on, you know, forever. But, you know, if you think about, I suppose if you think about the local group of stars, think about the sun, think about Proxima Centauri and Alpha Centauri, maybe that little group of stars nearby, you could imagine that as you were moving away, you'd feel a stronger force from the sun until you get, you know, maybe a bit more than halfway or whatever it might be, roughly halfway to the nearest other star, when the gravity of that would start to dominate over the sun. So you can get a long way out from the sun, certainly as far as the Oort cloud, quarter of the way to the nearest star, and still be under the gravitational influence of the sun, and therefore it's no surprise that they're still on these orbits that may well lead to them eventually returning.
But Voyager, is that ever going to come back?
Oh, Voyager, well, no, Voyager's on a hyperbolic orbit, so it's unbound, yeah. Okay. There's often this claim made that at the speed of Voyager, it would reach the nearest other star in, is it 70,000 years, I think? But of course it's not heading directly towards the nearest other star.
So we can look forward to that argument about when it leaves the solar system continuing for thousands of years.
Yeah. Yes. When it leaves the gravitational influence of the sun. Absolutely. It's all about cosmic rays, isn't it, this heliosphere? It's quite an interesting thing to follow, is the looking at these cosmic ray particles which came from the sun and measuring the sort of numbers of them hitting the spacecraft, and you can sort of tell when you've reached this boundary between the region where there's the sun's cosmic rays and the sort of external interstellar medium.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You can still send information back.
Yeah. No, it is. It is very, very exciting stuff.
The third and final question comes from Great Old Mac, and this one's about planetary nebulae. He says, many detailed images of planetary nebulae have streamers of material and they are described as knots. Are the knots and streamers really super comets in the equivalent of the Oort cloud for that star?
Yeah, I mean, we picked all the questions that have this orbits, comets, Oort cloud theme for this week. I mean, I don't know whether people have seen these pictures of things like the Helix Nebula or the Ring Nebula or these planetary nebulae, very beautiful pictures. Basically, they show this shell of gas that surrounds a white dwarf star. So these are the sort of end points of the evolution of stars like the Sun. So eventually, in, you know, several billion years, the Sun will run out of hydrogen fuel at its core, and it'll expand to become a red giant. And then a little while after that, it'll actually expand even farther, such that the outer layers of the star are so far from the middle that they're very loosely bound gravitationally to it, and they can effectively be pushed off out into space by the force of the radiation that's coming out from the centre. And so what happens is all the outer layers of the star pushed out into space, leaving behind the exposed core of the star, something maybe the size of the Earth or something, where all the nuclear reactions used to take place, and that's the white dwarf, hot, exposed, dead core of the star. But that hot core has all this ultraviolet light. It ionises this outflowing gas, the outer layers of the original star, and they shine, and we see that as this planetary nebula. Nothing to do with planets, really, just something that looked a bit like a planet when people first saw them in telescopes, you know, a few hundred years ago. So actually, when you look in detail at these shells of gas, they often have these knots, these sort of bright condensations, if you like, sort of blobs within the shell. And then you can even see on these blobs that they've got these tails sticking out from them away from the central star. So they look like comets, actually, you know, with the tails pointing away from the star, just like comets' tails point away from the Sun. And so the question here is whether actually those knots, often called cometary knots because they look like comets, may in fact even be comets. You know, maybe they are comets in the Oort cloud of the star that evolved, became the red giant, and then ejected its outer layers to become the planetary nebula. Now, in fact, that has been discussed. The sizes of some of these planetary nebulae are not dissimilar to the size of, say, the Oort cloud around the Sun, so it's not unreasonable. It has been discussed, it has been thought about, but generally it's not thought to be the best explanation. One of the reasons is that where we've been able to try and estimate the masses of these knots, there's something like the masses of our planets, so the, you know, of order of Earth mass type things, whereas comets, as we know them, are much less massive than a planet. Now, I know that great old Mac said that super comets, so actually, you know, in that sense, that would have to be right. They'd have to be extremely large comets, but there's certainly nothing like the comets we know. Now, the best explanation, you know, that I think most astronomers would agree on for what these things actually are, is they're thought to be instabilities in the gas that form as it's pushed out from the central star. So as this planetary nebula is expanding and growing, and there's a couple of things that go on. One is that the actual radiation from the central white dwarf, eventually when it's exposed, and earlier than that as well, that radiation pushes stuff out. That can effectively, you know, it crinkles the layer of gas that's being pushed out. It's called a Rayleigh-Taylor instability. Same thing you'd see in if you try and we've seen this done, but if you've got a glass of water and you poured a layer of sort of oil in on top of it, it's a sort of unstable situation that can result in this, the heavier stuff sort of penetrating through into the water in sort of streamers. That surface becomes unstable and you get these sort of streamers of material that flow down through. That's called the Rayleigh-Taylor instability, and that same instability acts in these so-called ionization fronts as the ionizing radiation pushes out through the gas. The other thing that's pushing is actually the particle wind, so the gaseous wind from the star. So we seem to see a sort of slower wind initially, and then as more of the hot core gets exposed, the wind increases in speed. And so the fast stuff runs into the slow stuff that was previously ejected, and that's also unstable in a similar way, and that would produce these clumps and streamers as the gas flows past the clumps, and it sort of drags out these cometary tails. So that's the best explanation, but you know, I have to say that, you know, that option of super comets has been discussed, but not generally thought to be the best explanation.
So the knots are probably gas then, rather than sort of solid?
Yeah. I think the knots are basically condensations of gas, so denser gas than in the surrounding regions. I mean, there's lovely observations of these things with, you know, particularly at high resolution with things like the Hubble Space Telescope, where you can see the front surface of these sort of blobs of gas all ionized by the ultraviolet light from the star. So you see this sort of ionized front, and then you see the gas that sort of boiled off almost off the clump being sort of dragged out behind it. Mm. And you can sort of measure the flows of material in that and in, you know, in some detail. So a nice little bit of physics in these planetary nebulae.
Yeah. I might have to try pouring some oil onto water as well. To create some streamers of my own.
Google Rayleigh Taylor instability. See what you find.
Thank you very much to Derek Kilkenny Blake, Pat O'Grady and Great Old Mac for the questions. And if you'd like to send in questions to be answered next time, you can do so via all the usual channels.